Hello, and welcome to EPR with your favorite environmental nerds, Nick and Laura. On today's episode, we give our shout-outs. Laura and I discuss the return to traveling now that COVID restrictions have lifted. We sit down with Ron Deverman, the Vice President and National Environmental Planning Leader at STV, to talk about farming, career advice, and poetry. And finally, people tend to brush their teeth more vigorously on the side of their dominant hand. Right-handed people brush more on the right, and left-handed people brush more on the left. This can lead to you having one side of your teeth that are like super clean and the other kind that are pretty clean. But the next time you are brushing your teeth, pay attention to which side of your mouth you brush on, and it just might blow your mind.
That's interesting.
Right? I thought that was fun. And I started doing it, and I was brushing my teeth. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm spending all of my time on the right side of my mouth. Yeah, it was pretty funny. So
I was trying to think where my cavities are.
Hand. Please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. Hit that music.
Our shout out for today goes to Bill Plumpton, winner of the 2021 Norm Arnold Award. Not to be confused with the Norm McDonald
Award. Very different.
Totally different thing. Bill has been an NAEP member for over 30 years. He is the Senior Vice President and Director of Environmental Management and Natural Resources at Gannett Fleming in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. He has served on NAEP's Board of Directors for 14 years, and his actions support the board to ensure long-term relevancy and the financial health of NAEP. So thanks for all you do, Bill.
Yeah, absolutely. Really love having you part of the board. He's great.
Be sure to share your promotions, new jobs, professional and project awards with us on the EPR website so we can give you a shout out here. And today's episode is sponsored by STV. STV is an award-winning professional firm consistently ranked among the country's top companies in education, justice, highways, bridges, rail, and mass transit sectors. This success is the direct result of their employees' commitment to innovation and quality. Throughout the U.S. and Canada, STV's professional, technical, and support personnel offer services to a broad and expanding client base. If you would like to sponsor a future episode, head over to www.environmentalprofessionalsradio.com and fill out the sponsor form. Let's get to our segment.
Cool.
Let's talk about that. I'm so, like, I'm a little jealous myself about you getting to actually go out and travel places right now.
Yeah.
But I'm also a little bit like, I don't know if realistically I'd want to be traveling that much right now either. So I'm curious to know what it's like. Like, what has it been like going from like zero to full stop?
150,000 miles an hour. So like the first time I flew, right, I immediately got delayed for 3 hours. And I was like, okay, great. That's a nice, healthy reminder of what it's like to travel.
Right, yeah.
Right. It's like, oh yeah, you have to do early morning flights because everything else in the afternoon is going to be later than it says. And it's just the truth. So yeah, okay, that's good to know. Thank you for reminding me. And then I got, you know, my very first Uber driver to the hotel was just crazy. And there's no other word for it. And
crazy how? Like crazy driving or crazy?
No. He was basically talking about how he didn't, you know, care at all about the pandemic and he was out here driving the whole time.
Oh,
you're like,
oh,
cool. Okay. Right. And I thought that was bad. And then we got to the hotel and there's a gate and the gate has to lift up. And he's like, oh yeah, last time I was here, the gate wouldn't let me out. So I ran inside and yelled at everybody. Pretty bad, actually. I was really angry. And I'm like, why are you telling me this? I don't understand.
Okay. So like literally crazy. All right.
Yeah. Like literally just like, and like all of our conversations were like, this might be it. This may be the end of old Nick here.
It's like last week I had this major road rage and I murdered someone.
I killed one of my passengers. But you know they can't give me a rating, so I still have 5 stars. But yeah, it was kind of crazy. The first time was pretty tough. But there's been a couple, like the flights aren't always full yet. Some of them are. Most of the smaller ones are. But I did do a flight where I had three seats on either side, and I had nobody next to me. So yeah, it was great. But yeah, you know, I mean, the standard rules of travel are pretty much back. I mean, it's the weird thing too about the hotels, the airports, is the restaurants aren't all open. It's like maybe, and it depends on which one you're in, you know, like half of the ones in Atlanta are open, which seems great until you go to like, you know, F gate or whatever. And there's like a food court and everything is closed. And so you have to go back. I had to like track back to like the very beginning to get food.
Oh, I hate that because I hate that in a normal airport when you're like, oh, there's a Cinnabon and you get there and you're like, oh, man, they closed an hour ago.
Yeah, I know. Right. It's always tough. But now it's like that. Yeah. They're just, you don't know what's actually open, even though they have the signs for everything. You're like, oh, great. Yeah, exactly. Oh, Cinnabon. This is good for me. And then, you know, the universe decides, no, you will not have that today. So yeah, it's a little bit, there's less people still. Like I can tell it's not as busy. But it's getting like, you know, I say I've been doing this for like almost a full month now, actually more than a full month. And it's, yeah, it's definitely busier. And so the flights are getting fuller. Everybody's still wearing their masks. Everybody's still being polite. At least I haven't seen any of that come through, which is good.
But people are being nice to each other.
Yeah. Nobody's talking to each other. Like that's the thing. I haven't had one person try to talk to me on a plane. And yeah, it's, you know, and like I say, I like to talk to people. I like to meet people, but when I'm on a plane, I don't as much. Because I'm just like, okay, I did all that. I did all my talking and I'm tired now and I just want to go to sleep. You know, if you do an early morning flight, there's way less talking anyway because everybody's, again, trying to, like, they woke up at 4:30 in the morning and they're like, okay, well, I got on this plane, so now I'm going to take a nap, which is totally fine. But I think it's just also a shift a little bit in what you do on a plane, right? Everybody's got their own headsets. They got their own, like, you know, entertainment to watch. And it's actually interesting to see the differences between the airlines. Like, American actually has done away with the screen. So you download their app and you watch the screen on whenever you, when you are on your phone, on your tablet or whatever it is.
Yeah, on your device.
And so, yeah. And they even have like a little like holder that you can put up on this in the back side of the seat that'll put up your.
Oh gosh, how many people are leaving their stuff there?
I know. Well, I mean, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, put it there with a little rope attached.
Yeah, right.
Charger on it or something. Right.
Yeah. Hopefully, you know, using your headphones, you know, you remember. But yeah, you're right. I'm sure people do. And they do it anyway. People put it.
Yeah.
They actually say you're not allowed, like the rules on the airliner, you're not allowed to put it, your tablets or your laptops in the pouches in the back of the seat. And I think honestly, that's just so you don't leave it there.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure people do. I'm surprised I haven't, honestly. But then Delta still has the screens and you still have to plug in directly to it. But yeah, also, but Delta also didn't, you know, delay my flight for 3 hours yet. So, you know, it's just a difference in airline. You know, it just depends. Everybody's got their own. And where I am, Delta makes more sense because if I do American, the hub for American is Charlotte or Miami. And Charlotte is literally a 2-hour drive from me. So it's a just worthless flight. And it gets delayed all the time, which is really funny. So it always takes longer to get there to fly than it would to drive. Always. So at least Delta's hub is in Atlanta. So it's easy. And Atlanta's an easy airport.
I'm a big fan of Delta.
You have?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. So we're Delta fans. Let's see if they'll sponsor the episode here. But I love it though, because people have really strong opinions about this. Like there's some people that hate Delta. And just, I think it's really an interesting thing. It's like informed experience, right? Like whatever your experience with an airline is exactly how you feel about that airline, regardless of whether they're actually good or bad. Because they're kind of pretty much the same, I think. There's not a ton of differences, but yeah, it's just that short flight to Charlotte kills me. I can't do
Delta
it.
Delta made some early on commitments to environmental improvements. I obviously have, not obviously, but I don't have any idea where they're at with those commitments and what the other airlines are doing. But I know that they were at least one of the first.
Yeah. Oh, you know that they've actually tested a small scale version of an electric engine for jets.
Yeah.
Like all electric. And it is like super cool. So, I mean, like and maybe it's really more like, you know, practically like the 2040s. So you could have an electric jet out there or a commercial jet.
I don't know.
That would be really cool.
Stuff is coming pretty quick. They just got to make the battery smaller.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, I know, right? And then they also maybe should make them so they don't light on fire.
We can talk about those future technologies another time. Let's get to our segment for today.
All right, cool.
Our interview.
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do that.
Okay, welcome back to your favorite podcast, EPR. We're so very thankful to have Ron Deverman on the show today. He's a vice president and the National Environmental Planning Leader at STV. He's also a past president of NAEP, a published poet, and an NAEP fellow. Ron, thank you so much for being here.
Woo-hoo. Oh, it's great to be here. Great to see both of you.
Yeah, so why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do?
What I do? Well, I've now got about, it's definitely over 35 years of managing very large transportation infrastructure projects, you know, the NEPA.
Yeah.
phase one environmental and preliminary engineering, you know, all types of transit and rail. And, you know, early in my career, I did highways and bridges because my first job was actually in the central office of the Illinois DOT and the Bureau of Design and Environment. And I was actually hired as a technical writer to write EISs cover to cover. And yeah, so that was kind of crazy. But what was really good about it, I liked working with the different resource area specialists. You know, in the in the environmental department, somebody would be a specialist in biology, you know, natural resources or air quality, noise, cultural resources. And then I'd have to work with all of them to get the information, you know, put together and do the environmental impacts and write up the documents. So I learned a lot. In fact, the first EIS I wrote was actually challenged in court. I didn't realize that it was such a controversial project. It was a new Illinois River crossing in central Illinois on the Central Illinois Expressway. So there was a lot of issues with threatened endangered species and cultural resources to the tune of Indian burial mounds. And I could just go on and on and on. So, but I wrote that EIS and it stood the test in court. And
great.
And that's how you learn by fire, I think. Just jump in.
Yeah. No kidding. And well, so what kind of even drew you to the environmental field in the first place?
You know, I've been thinking a lot about that, especially in the past year. My dad passed away in 2020 on February 29th, but he lived a very, very long, productive life of 95 years. And he was a farmer until age 75. And he was one of the first, I think maybe the first farmer in central Illinois to practice no-till farming. And what that means, it's very little disturbance of the soil after the crops are harvested. So you don't get the wind and rain erosion like the old style of farming. And so he helped teach some of the other farmers how to do it and what equipment to buy and that sort of thing. And then he was very much into soil and water conservation. He did that at the county level. He became the president of the Illinois State Soil and Water Conservation Districts in the mid-1980s. He won all kinds of land conservation awards and that sort of thing, and was very involved with the community too in many ways, and even deacon of his church. He was one of our great World War II veterans in the U.S. U.S. Navy, and he was actually in the submarine, the USS Blackfish. You can imagine being in a World War II submarine. It's I can't even imagine.
Oh, I can't either. No. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's like living in a soup can, you know, I think.
right. Yeah.
So he did really, and I'm the executor of the estate now too, because I actually farmed in partnership with him for a while. And so I feel very honored to be the executor, number one. But then again, being in his study and seeing all the different conservation awards that he won over the years, it's just very impressive. And it really came back to me, I think, this year at how much he influenced me, you know, in my career and my love for the environment. So.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I don't know. Do you still get to farm?
The farming operation is still going. It's 500 acres. My cousin Ken actually farmed it for 20 years, but then when he retired, his nephew, Ty Willis, is farming it the last couple of years, and he's doing a fantastic job. I just have to interface a little bit now and again, but he's making all those farming business decisions. So
that's really cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, you also, switching gears a little bit, you also run NAEP's Leadership Development Initiative.
How did
that get started? Yeah.
Well, I think we were having a chapter retreat a few years back, and the idea kind of came up, and I thought about it, and I said, yeah, we really need to think in the context of a more leadership development within NAEP, and especially our emerging, you know, members and professionals and that sort of thing. And then so we started the leadership blog here in the last couple of years. In a way, I see EPR as an outgrowth of that leadership and that outreach. Yeah. And then I've been very involved with the NAP, American Public University Student Chapter. And in fact, we just had a meeting last week and interfacing with them, and they're interested in different environmental topics. And so I'll get a speaker, you know, somebody from NAP to come in and talk about whether it's a career in natural resources or in, you know, federal service, like the U.S. Forest Service, for example, and just a lot of different topics. So that's been really
earlier this year.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah. I attended that meeting. I thought you just did a great job.
Okay. Well, thank you. Yeah. Appreciate that. I was really glad I could be part of it.
Mm-hmm. And so that's, kind of foremost in my mind. I felt certainly as a past president and an NAP fellow, that's just another way I can continue to give back, you know. So, yeah, I've been a member since 1990, and I actually attended my first conference in 1989, and I was still at the Illinois DOT at the time of that first conference. And I have to admit, you know, like I was listening to the different sessions, and especially the NEPA track, and I saw some of our real NEPA pioneers like Rich McLean and Don Hunsaker, and even Linton, believe it or not, Linton Caldwell himself, who crafted NEPA and developed the concept of the EIS. He came and spoke. CEQ Council, Dinah Bear. I mean, it was just amazing people. But when I saw Rich McLean delivering a presentation on NEPA, it's like it just struck me as said, okay, I want to be like him when I grow up. You know, it's right? that kind of realization. Yeah, for sure. Like, okay, this is the place for me. So, yeah. And that's why I've been over the years very, very, you know, committed to NAP and the chapters. I lived in the Pacific Northwest for a while, about 5 years in the early to mid 90s. And I co-founded the Northwest chapter then. And probably the people that are leaders of the Northwest chapter probably don't even know that fact.
Yeah, I don't think I knew that. That's really cool.
Yeah, because most of the energy was in the Seattle area at the time. And then it kind of moved down to Portland. And now it's really awesome into, you know, both places. And so they have very, very active chapter now. But that was me. I think it was in 1990, actually, when I met some other people from the Seattle area, and we were so taken with the NAP conference and loved it so much, we said, let's go found a chapter, you know. And there we went, and that's what we did. So
that's great. How big is it the Illinois chapter? What region are you covering?
Yeah, we cover the entire Chicago region. Believe it or not, we even have a couple members that actually officially live in Wisconsin and one in Indiana, but, you know, they're driving to work in the Chicago region. Okay. We have about, I think it's 350 to 400 members constantly. Awesome. And what's incredible is we have 45 corporate members.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which again, they get 5 members of each firm gets a discount on, you know, when we have our webinars and seminars and that sort of thing. So that's very impressive. And the Illinois chapter, IAP, was one of the 3 original NAP chapters. So it dates all the way back to 1975, just like when NAP was founded. So,
oh, wow, it's fantastic.
Yeah. And then we do have some people in Springfield. That's the state capital. So all of the resource and regulatory agencies there. Mm-hmm. And the plan was to actually have a couple of events down there last year. Of course, the pandemic kind of put that on pause, but we're hoping once everything opens up again, we're going to do that. I've been in touch with a couple of the environmental professors at U of I Springfield campus, and that's actually where I got my master's in English. And then, of course, U of I Urbana, the main campus, that's where I got my civil engineering degree. But I've been in touch with the environmental professors down there. And so we'll do something when we can. So
nice.
Yeah.
I want to just touch base on the leadership stuff again really quickly. There is a leadership blog on the website that people can check out, and Ron does a lot of writing for that. And then you're also the leading on our webinar, two webinars a year on leadership that are free. So the next one, by the time this comes out, it will already aired, and it is devoted to environmental and social justice and equity issues. And just kind of wanted to know for you to tell us what you're hoping that that will accomplish and why it's so important.
Yeah, I think, I think our mindsets and our hearts have really changed, over the last year with Black Lives Matter and our attention on social justice, equity in the professions. And we're even seeing that in our transit projects with social equity and that kind of thing. And one of our environmental professionals in LA, who was a speaker, worked on a gender action plan, for example, for LA Metro. And so it's very, very much on our minds, and we really need to be respectful to everyone. So it's very important. And that's why it's, for me, I just want to emphasize that a lot. And I think it was, last September, if you remember, I moderated the applying multiple approaches within, for diversity, equity, and inclusion within the environmental professions.
That was a great webinar.
And I want to do another one of those as well, maybe early fall. It'd be good to do that. Someone of my leadership team, Heidi Hartman at Argonne National Laboratory, was telling me about all the great things they're doing there. And so she'll probably be a speaker or have somebody represent Argonne. As one example.
I think that's the difference now than all the times we've had these conversations before in the past, right? We have to keep this going.
Yeah. And the other thing I just thought of, and it really does go back to my father again and my mother and how I was brought up, it's not about, what you look like or the views you may hold. It's just who you are inside as a person.
Yes.
And to really value the uniqueness of your humanness. And that's how I was brought up. And so, I was never brought up around racism or anything like that. I just, everyone was an equal human being, So,
Yeah, that's great. I always love the way you talk about your parents.
Yeah, it's great. And it's really refreshing. I think it speaks to who you are as a person. And, I think the more we've gotten to know each other, the more we've learned from you, just another way you give back. You're an adjunct professor at Northwestern University, and you teach a master's course in NEPA. So, you're also giving back in that way. So what drew you to teaching, and how do you see your role as a mentor?
Actually, the first time I taught was actually even when I was at IDOT. They needed someone at the local community college there to teach fiction writing and short story writing and stuff like that. And I said, well, I can do that, okay.
right.
But I will say I've taught that course now for six fall quarters. Of course, in 2020, it was virtual. But frankly, Northwestern University reached out to me because in their adjunct faculty, they actually want people, professionals doing real jobs in the profession and in the area that you're teaching about. So what's really cool, and I can give them my students the just sort of basics of NEPA or context sensitive solutions, but then I can tie it to real projects I've managed, and so each project, as is so unique, and there's a cast of characters and on and so I just tell stories about these projects and the crazy things that go on while I'm managing, and the students like, what, that really happened? But I think it gives them a much more heartfelt and absorption of the principles that I'm actually teaching. So, and I love it. And I just love being back on campus too. So,
Do you have a favorite project you've worked on that you like to share with them?
Well, I, for about 9 or 10 years, I was the overall program manager for the rail side of IDOT on the CREATE program. It's in the Chicago region here. It's actually a program of 70 rail improvement projects. And at any given week, there's about 24 active projects we're overseeing. But I will say, I thought, you know, I provided the management and oversight for the 75th Street Corridor Improvement Projects, and it's on the Chicago South Side. And I do harken back to that one a lot as a, for examples, because of the community outreach that we did and working with the aldermen and the public officials and community interest groups and that sort of thing. You know, we had some over 40 community interest groups involved with that. And then the faith community was very involved. We actually held our public meetings in churches because they were safe places. So got a lot of support on the South Side. In fact, I'm going to be presenting on that project at the NAP virtual conference.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I need to connect to some people here in Syracuse with you. I don't know if you know anything about the I-81.
There you go, Laura. You got it.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, what do I call it politically correctly? The I-81 decision. It's been hanging out there for years, but the city can't figure out what to do with the, it's a overpass highway. So it's dual levels.
Oh, yeah.
And it's aged out. And, you know, should we make it a tunnel? Should we rebuild it as it is? Should they, you know, make it a parkway? The question remains. And it sounds like you could have some maybe insight for us here in Syracuse.
Yeah. I managed another project I liked was the project I-375 in Detroit. And basically that was all about deconstructing an interstate spur that went through lower income and minority neighborhoods back in the early 1960s. Mm-hmm. And they're now Michigan DOT, along with the city of Detroit, they're going to reconstruct it into a boulevard to totally reconnect the neighborhoods, add, you know, bike lanes, multimodal, you know, transportation, active transportation, and that sort of thing. It's just a really great project to work on. And I did talk about that project last year in 2020 at the NAP conference, and I've actually expanded that now. The whole concept is interstates to boulevards. So you can actually Google interstates to boulevards, and then you see it's sort of like righting the wrongs of past, you know, and reconnecting neighborhoods, making them walkable again. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually speaking in June on an international conference that's going to be virtual this year on that topic, and kind of expand that to the point of then ultimately writing a paper on it. So
awesome. I'm glad I asked this question. Yeah. I have resources to bring here into Syracuse. Not that
interstates to boulevards.
I'll make sure. Yeah.
Well, it's actually a really good segue. Like, we like to do a thing we call field notes, where we ask funny stories from the field. And you were an environmental compliance coordinator for the construction of a new, was it I-405 Cedar River Bridge?
Oh, that's right. That's right. And that was a real fun project. That was kind of a 24/7. For Washington DOT, I was the environmental coordinator. I had to do all the compliance. I had to do aquifer awareness training, because the city's sole source aquifer was only about 10 to 15 feet below the soil surface. And here they are building a new bridge, you know? And also, so a lot of training there for the construction workers and compliance. So one time, I was out by the river and going through I had an inspection sheet related to the storage of hazardous materials and other things I had to inspect every day. And I saw the watering truck, you know, it lays the dust, you know, so you don't have a lot of fugitive dust during construction with the equipment. And so the driver, let's just say he had to do some business. And so he parked his truck actually facing the river and went into the porta potty, but he didn't set the brake, and went into the river.
Oh my goodness.
And so it was just, you know, all out alarmed, you know,
of course,
and stuff.
Of course, yes.
And, But I had trained the construction workers and stuff when we put out the booms, you know, around the truck that captures oil and gas, you know, and that sort of thing. We did that, I mean, just almost immediately. And we just went into action and stuff. And then there was a crane that was helping kind of lift it. And then a bulldozer came over had a big chain, and we hooked it on the back of it. And we had just pulled it out of his truck out of the water.
Yeah.
It was still hooked to the bulldozer when the guy comes out of the porta potty. Okay. And it's like, what's going on here? You
know? Of course.
Well, your truck just took a dive into the river there.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, Washington State's highest quality salmon spawning river.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Course.
The Cedar River there.
Of course.
Yeah.
So, oh, gosh.
Yeah. Crazy, crazy times.
That's why we like to tell these stories, though. So young people listening, like, you're going to mess up. Something's going to happen, but it's okay.
Yeah. That's a pretty big one. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, do you have any specific advice to give to environmental professionals looking to get into their careers, maybe specifically into transportation and NEPA kind of projects?
Yeah, I actually mentioned this to my students at Northwestern as well. What gravitated me, I think, to transportation infrastructure in the context of NEPA is that that type of infrastructure touches all the resource areas with social and land use, environmental, you know, and it's just been incredibly, incredibly interesting to manage those types of projects. So you get a real breadth and depth of experience in all resource areas. So I do encourage young professionals to think about that if they have opportunities to work for state DOTs or even regional. We do a lot of work for regional transportation and transit authorities. And I especially like transit myself now because there's a lot of placemaking, you know, and transit-oriented development around the stations, and really, really enjoy that. And one of the first transit jobs I managed was out in Denver. And we actually had a very multidisciplinary team, including actually a visual and sound artist, believe it or not, that worked collaboratively together to do different placemaking and artistic spaces at the transit stops.
Nice.
And that was just really, really interesting. And I love doing that type of thing. So, yeah.
Great. I do have a follow-up question. I've been talking to some people recently who are trying to get into, or recent graduates trying to get into urban planning and not really sure what the entry-level steps are. Like, where could they make those first entries? What job titles should they be searching for?
Yeah, they should be able to come in, you know, as a, you know, first-level planner. What I've enjoyed, like I said, early in my career, I was, you know, I did work for the DOT, but since then I've actually, you know, been working in the private sector in consulting. And I've liked that a lot because consulting firms especially will help young professionals pay for advanced degrees and, you know, other training and education and that kind of thing. So I think that's real important. And I find, you know, I guess another thing with managing large major projects is it takes a team, you know, and so you learn a lot about just being in and what your role in the team is and how you help the team be successful. And you can learn that right away in your first job because of that team environment. And then you pick up a lot of things too. I did have a couple mentors early in my career that were project managers, you know, professionals. And I, you know, with the thing with mentoring is you just don't have to do anything. You just have to be. And if someone is mentoring you, I just sort of absorb what they're doing, you know, and that's what I did early in my career. I just sort of, wow, I see how he handled that situation or how he talked to the client or somebody. Yeah, I get that. I get it.
Yeah.
And so now I think I've had the opportunity to mentor people. And again, it's nothing I have to do overtly. I just sort of go about and do my business, you know?
So. Yeah. It's a great answer. And I could say, I wish We're almost out of time, and we really could talk to you for another hour. It's just such a great wealth of knowledge that you have. And we teased this at the beginning, though, because you are also a published poet. So tell us a little bit. How did you get into poetry? Where does that love come from?
It actually, the first poem I wrote when I was, I think, 19, and I think I was just with my family, mom and dad and my brother and little sister at the time, and we were just down in the Carolinas, and I just sort of walked off, and then I found this little stream and in a woods, and then this waterfall and stuff, and it just struck me, and I came back, and I actually wrote my first poem called "The Waterfall Knows." And since then, I've just made it an avocation. At one point, I thought, okay, should I go in this direction and just become a professor, university professor, and write and publish books? But I loved managing projects and being involved, as I say, with the environmental studies. So I went that way. And my hope is that I've kept this avocation up throughout all these decades. And I'm very, very involved with the Northwest Cultural Council, which is a group of not only poets, but visual artists. And we get together. In fact, just last Saturday, we got together on a Zoom call and shared some of our work and that sort of thing. So I've just been doing that, you know, all my life, and plan to actually publish a lot more when I do finally retire from the environmental profession. So
that's so great. Yeah. And so why poetry over other forms of writing? Is it just what spoke to you?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It just speaks to me. And it also takes me to a deeper level of myself.
Yeah.
If you think in the context of self-actualization and working up, well, you can even think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
And at the very top of the pyramid there is self-actualization, and how important that is to have, you know, both your human side and the analytical side, and just kind of working on all cylinders, you know?
Yeah. 100% agree. That's very, very important.
So, Ron, is there a poem that you could recite for us to close out our show?
Yeah, I'd love to do that. And in fact, this poem, Total Eclipse, Carbondale, Illinois, it's when back in, I think it was 2017, in August, where it was 100% total eclipse. And so my wife, Mary, and I, we drove down there, and Mary has a niece, Colleen, and so we were able to stay at her house the night before and the night of, because you probably heard the highways were just bumper to bumper traffic trying to because even Nassau had actually come and set up a facility at Carbondale because it was 100%. And this is also the poem at the 2018 conference in Tacoma when I accepted the NAP Fellow Award. I actually had written this poem. It came out very quickly from, August of 2017. And here it's March of 2018. And I had written it just in those couple months before. So, Total Eclipse. When the moment is here and the day goes dark in context, when the locusts, crickets, and insects unlock their garden of sound, and the birds land to be with their shadows, and the agile wind quiets. When the clouds unfold and open to the black round star in an enormous white ring of flame. When loved ones gasp, become silent, or cheer, and the roads reach that substantial point of no movement. And for 360 degrees around the horizon, the sunset tells its story with a gleaming amber glow, and you are an island of complete wonder. Look to that essential human being next to you and take heart. Take this stunning moment and forget everything you know. Start your truest perspectives, your dazzling lives anew. There's a clear way back together on the other side.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
Crickets.
Thank you. No, thank you so much, Ron.
You have to breathe that one in.
Yeah,
I know.
That's the biggest wow. The biggest wow for me was at that very moment in time of 100% eclipse. Yeah. You could see the sunset all the way around.
All the way around.
Yes. I didn't expect that one.
It's so incredible. Your imagery there is so good. I really, really appreciated that. So thank you. Thank you so, so much. It really has been our pleasure to have you here. And is there anything else you'd like to share with us before we get you out of here?
Oh, I think I'm good. It's been great, great talking with both of you.
You too, Ron. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, that's our show. Huge thanks to Ron Deverman for joining us today. Yeah. I feel like I had an NAP fellow with me at TBAP with Bruce Hasbrook, and now I have Ron sort of with me at NAP. It's really great.
Yeah, he was so fun. So good to have him on, and just really a good, genuine person. And it's such a great thing.
Yeah, great human.
Yes. We need more of those in the world. More Rons, please.
All right. Please be sure to check us out next Friday. And also, before you leave here today, subscribe, rate, and give us a nice review.
All right. Bye. Thanks, everybody. Bye.